Unfortunately, the mayor has asked me to extend his apologies to everyone. He had death in the family, and he's trying to prepare to go away to take care of that. However, he knew the Majetti was coming in today, and being he thinks so much of the Majetti, he stayed here to make sure that his presence was known during the Heritage Day Parade. What that means to us who are propagating al-Islam is that we have a lot to be thankful for. And one day we can have a mayor, Kenneth A. Gibson, the mayor of Newark, and the Majetti, our leader, on the same podium with thousands of Muslims parading in the city of Newark. We have come a long way. Allahu Akbar. We know it was a blessed day. Before the parade started, it was raining very hard. Although Allah seen fit of the gathering of many Muslims, He allowed us to finish the parade. And right after Majetti got finished giving his brief speech, the rain continued. Allahu Akbar. We're not going to hold you much longer. We know why you are here. You're here to hear the message, and surely they have one for you. If you could be just patient for a few more minutes, we will continue with the program. Did everybody enjoy themselves today? We thank all the brother imams who came from the other communities to the city of Newark. This is a testimony for our community in Newark, showing that we are organized, we're doing good things today, and hopefully we'll be even doing better tomorrow.
Brothers and sisters, it gives me great pride to be here. Once again in the city of Newark, I have came here a lot of times, and one of the times that gave me such a great pride was when I received the key to the city of Newark. And to me, besides my new home in Jenkintown, Newark is number one in my books. As-salamu alaykum.
Who's constantly showing us the way? Brother Imam Hussein Shabazz.
Blessings upon his servant and his messenger Muhammad forever. Amen. I bear witness there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad of 1400 years ago was his slave servant and his messenger. First of all, I'd like to say I'm not going to come up here and say anything in front of our leaders. I've said on many occasions that I think that that is almost insanity. And here he comes. All praise to Allah. And now we're going to have the resident imam, Newark, New Jersey.
Praise God.
Stop there. Stop there. Stop there. Stop there.
As-salamu alaykum.
I thank Allah that He has blessed me to be present with you once again in Newark. I recall the last time I was here, and there were so many Muslims together to hear me speak that day when I was here in Newark. And I was really surprised to see so many Muslims gathered here in Newark. I had heard that many, many African Americans, Bilalians as we call ourselves in the community, that many identified with the religion and many were declared Muslim. But I never expected to see that many Muslims of Newark gathered that day. And since then, I have thought of Newark as the Mecca of the future for Muslims in the United States. It wasn't long after that I was addressing a large, very large gathering in New York City. I know New York City has a history for big crowds, you know. But I wondered, I said, I'm going to ask, how many of these people are from Newark? I said that in my mind. So I said, how many of you are from Newark? And when they stood, my curiosity was satisfied. Let me say, dear beloved brothers and sisters, that the experience I had today, spiritual experience, what went on within me while I was watching the Black Heritage Day parade there from the observer's stand, if I could explain it to you, I'm sure it would make all of us shout. But I can't put it into words. It would take too long. But I hope in saying a few words on my experience there, you will understand what I'm talking about. I was told that this parade would be a salute to Black heritage. That the city had, the year previous, that the city had given the parade to honor or to commemorate the great personality Christopher Tuck and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And today, while I was sitting there and knowing the history behind the parade, I just had all kind of strong emotions staring in me, because Muslims were very significant in this parade. Not only were Muslims participating, but your imam was honored to be the deputy marshal for this parade. I felt so very good. And when I saw the Muslims coming in the parade, our section of the parade coming, I couldn't hardly hold back the tears. This is really a wonderful day. And I told the Honorable Mayor, Kenneth Gibson, I told him, I have never witnessed a more significant parade put on in the city and representing so much of the city. We have had parades in Chicago now for two consecutive years. This will be the third, I believe, that's coming up. But we haven't had the kind of wide participation that I saw in this parade today. And I believe it's because we don't have a Bilalian or African American majority in Chicago. If we did, I think we would receive more support from upstairs. But I don't worry about that. I think we have made great progress even in Chicago. And I believe the future years will show more and more respect coming from above and below for each other. And that's what we have to have. We must have genuine respect for each other. We must respect ourselves. We must respect our brothers and sisters, our fellow citizens, regardless of what their role is in the community, regardless of the level that they're on in society, whether they are rich, whether they are intellectuals, whether they have power, governmental power, or not. We have to have mutual respect for each other as individuals, as persons, as human beings, and that respect shouldn't be violated for no reason. This is what we have to have. This will make us a society of people that can survive the test of the future. The future will test us. And if we are not really morally committed to respect the human person, then we won't survive the test of the future. Dear beloved people, I want to make a few more comments on today's activity that I am so grateful to have been a part of, and then I'll go on into my talk for tonight. I want to mention another something else, because I feel that when the right understanding is among us, then opportunity to advance is better for all of us. But when the understanding is not clear, then the opportunities are not so good for any of us, you see? And sometimes I don't like to bring up the bad side of things, the picture, but we have to sometimes. Now, what I want to say is this. This city is quite unique. It's not like all the other cities. And don't let anybody tell you it's like all the other cities. Anytime you have a majority Bilalian, a majority African American in the city, in the city, the big city like this, and you have an administration which is that is headed by an African American, Kenneth Gibson, and have important people on top from the Bilalian people, from the African-American people. I'm not speaking of Muslims now. I'm speaking of just African-American people in general. When you have that, you really have a struggle. You have a struggle. Because that kind of formation representing African-Americans has been feared in this country. Terribly feared in this country. I have been working hard to convince our non-Bilalian citizens of America that they have nothing to fear if their intentions are honorable. Because we haven't come through the kind of dehumanizing circumstances that they have come through. Ours have been of a different type. Oppression, denial of rights, freedom and rights, and the oppression that we have suffered until here recently, and we still suffer in some degree. That has not operated in our life to take out our humanity.
it has operated in our life to strengthen our humanity. We have become stronger humanly under pressure. And we have become stronger humanly under pressure because there was a demand on us to prove our legitimacy as an equal human being with all other people. The kind of mockery that was made of us and of our worth as people forced us to raise up our human dignity, to raise up the human qualities of our own being so that the world can see them, so that the Caucasian who said they are not there, so he can see them, you know? So we were forced to assert our humanity under the dehumanizing conditions that we find in our history here in America. Whereas a white man was not forced to assert his humanity. There was no pressure on him to assert his humanity. He was free, like a bear or a tiger or a wolf in the jungle. He was free. But we were in the cage. We were captive. And we were being told, you're not human. And he was telling his own people, they are not human. And he even told outsiders, Germans and Japanese, they are not human. You see? And we heard that, and that made us all the much more determined to prove our humanity. The experience has worked to make us better human beings, to make us trust human beings more. Naturally, we suspect Caucasians a little bit. We would be fools if we didn't suspect them a little bit. But we are still, I think, more ready to lay down the weapons of war than most of them are. I think we are more ready to declare a sincere truth. Say, man, no, look, no more race wars. No more race wars. No more slinging mud at each other. Let's forget this racial confrontation. I think we are more prepared, we are more ready to declare that kind of healthy decision than they are. It's because, and we know it, they know it too. We're trying to straighten it out. It's because they have guilt on their souls. They read the past and they know the past doesn't speak for them as it should speak for them who claim that they are interested in the well-being of all humanity. It doesn't speak as well for them as it should. And they know that even now, the majority of them are not prepared to stand aside and allow us the advancement we deserve. They know that still there's a majority of them that will either directly or covertly work against our advancement. They know that. So those that among them who really feel very healthy as human beings and are willing and ready to give us the same opportunities they claim for themselves, they are afraid that if we get too much too soon, our mind might revert back to yesterday without us having control over it, you know. And we might use that power to kind of even up some scores that should be buried and forgotten. If there's innocence on both sides. Well, that's a problem we have to live with, and a problem we have to try to correct. We have to do our best to correct it if we can. And I believe it can be corrected. I see more and more willingness in Caucasian people to get rid of that guilt complex they got and to just come out clean, to live with their fellow African American. Yes, more and more I'm seeing this, but there's not enough of it. And wherever there's a great concentration of us like there is in Newark, then we can expect the same kind of subtle sabotage, undermining that African nations have experienced in their days of freedom that has just come to them as it has just come to us. I'm referring to nations that recently got their independence from British domination or French domination or some other European domination or American domination. Those people's independence was so feared by those people who had exploited their weaknesses, had dominated them, that they made every attempt possible to discredit those people, to create problems that will strain their efforts for progress. And we have the same thing here. We have the same thing in Gary. We have the same thing wherever we have African-American leadership and a good number of African-Americans to support that leadership. We have that kind of struggle working to undermine and discredit our people. This is something we're going to have to live with. It's not because these people we call white folks or Caucasians are devils. It's not because they can't live a decent, honest, just life, accepting the rights of their fellow man, no matter what color his face is. No, it's not because of that. It's because of that guilt complex, the fear that if they get too much power and independence, their mind might revert back, and they might not be able to control the nightmare that will overtake them.
Mr. White Man, don't fear. We are more advanced than you think we are. We have progressed as a people, moving independently toward our own dignity. Some of you may say, Brother Imam, how can you say this is progress? Look how we are behaving now. Look how we are ignoring our responsibility to self, to family, to neighborhood, to our race. Look how we are ignoring our responsibility. Look how we have strayed away from our central concerns as a struggling people in American history. Look how we strayed away, Brother Imam. How can you say that we have progressed toward our dignity? I know what you know not. Most of us, we look at the surface activities, but we can't see into the secret workings, those workings that are going on in the subconscious. Most of you in this city are consciously dead. But the majority of you are subconsciously alive. I would say all of you are subconsciously alive. And if you are a doctor of the subconscious, like an imam is when he knows his business, you don't regard people who are consciously dead as being dead indeed. You regard them as being alive. And all it takes is just the right gesture. You don't even need a message. You don't have to preach a sermon. Just the right gesture can bring that dead person up to be a living being, ready to accept this responsibility. We grow on two levels. We grow on a conscious level, and we grow on a subconscious level. Subconsciously, we are an advanced people. Now, this might be difficult for some of you. Subconsciously, we are an advanced people, very advanced. I don't like to offend the self-image or the dignity of the Caucasian people in America. Don't tell them this. We are more advanced than they are. Yes, we are more advanced than they are. Let me see, can I quickly explain what I mean by this subconscious, on the subconscious level. We have undergone a process of growth as human beings, needing and demanding respect for our human worth. We have progressed and grown, and in this growth, we have been along the way observing the Caucasian deficiencies. And while we have been observing his deficiencies, we have been reaffirming our own worth as human beings. Subconsciously, we have been saying in the quietness of our soul, yeah, you were right, he's wrong. You're dignified, he's not. You're civilized, he's a savage. You're moral, he's immoral. We have been saying this. A lot of us haven't been speaking out, but the soul inside has been saying this. You'd be surprised to know what goes on that your ears never hear within your own being. So beneath this level of consciousness, there has been a growth. There has been an affirmation, affirming the dignity of the person and rejecting the influence from the savage. Oh, I don't want that. I don't want that. Most of you who have taken on the savage character here recently, you are just savages in your conscience. You are not savages in your subconscious. You are still Muslims in your subconscious. Oh, some of you out there will say, I've never been a Muslim. That's what you think. On the subconscious level, we have the pure mind of the individual. On the level of consciousness that keep us busy every day, trying to make the next month's rent,
trying to get the little child some sneakers so he can play in the gym tomorrow. I'm trying to just patch up this old pot or apartment so it won't look like a caveman's den. You know, those kinds of burdens that are on us want to keep us separated and won't allow us to really be in touch with the inner self, with the core person, the person in the core of the life. You know, nature is such that whenever there is a threat to survival, the survival instincts begin to operate. And a man who is poor and can't find a way, no possible way, a man who is poor and can't find any possible way except to break a moral law, when he sees his baby crying because he needs the bare necessities of life, when he sees his wife moaning and in misery, sad and all warped, spiritually and humanly, being twisted into a monster because he doesn't have the common things of life, that man, though he's morally right, he will break a moral law because survival instinct begin to operate. How should we say the people are sinners? The people are wicked, the people are immoral, or they break a law, or you shouldn't break a law under no circumstance. You should never violate a moral law under any circumstance. That's right. That is correct. But there's also an allowance made for those who break down under the strain. And out of dire necessity, break a law. Can a just Muslim judge chop off the hand of a Muslim who could not find work, who could not find charity, who could not find help enough to keep him from the desperate temptation? Should his hand be chopped off? No, the judge should say, I am obligated to do my part to correct this injustice in the society and make it possible for this man to earn at least his daily bread. The just Muslim judge, reading the Quran, he will understand that he is to weigh all the circumstances and judge not the offender by the crime itself separated from everything else, but he has to see the crime in the circumstances that touch upon that crime. And he has to make his judgment in that light. And the just judge will never send desperate poor people to jail, not to speak of cutting off their hands for stealing something as small as a loaf of bread or 5 pounds of meat, and they don't have any way to get it. Yes, certainly. Oh, amen, that you come here to this sinful city, to this crime-ridden city, to tell our criminals that they have a license from you to commit crime? No, 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 indeed. But I'm saying that there's an obligation on us as well as there's an obligation on them. There's a moral obligation on them to remain firm and steady and suffer the greatest test. But if they break down under it and their problem reflects on us, then we are obligated to do our part to correct that situation. And I tell you,
crime in this country used to be part of the business of this country. Now it has become, it seems, a burden that the country cannot get around. The leadership of this country must accept to eliminate those circumstances that breed crime, that deny the common people on the ground level the opportunity to live an honorable, decent life. What I'm saying is this, that we have problems in this city, too many poor people all together in one city, in one place, with the administration that represents them from their own people, that is, that's what I'm saying. We have terrible problems. Job opportunities are not there. And no moral leadership provided that will bring understanding to the mind of the moral people who are suffering this. You see? No future plan revealed that will quiet us.
We need foresight.
We need foresight on the part of our leaders in Washington, D.C.
On the local level.
On the local level
foresight.
As well. We need foresight. And we need them to share that foresight with all the people. Because these are very, 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 very trying times for all of us.
And if we don't have some proof,
and if we don't have some proof
that the leadership is working seriously,
that the leadership is working seriously on this problem
and see some light down the road ahead,
then we are going to be desperate people.
Or we are going to be no people at all.
What I mean by no people at all, we're going to give up our humanity and we will just destroy ourselves. And while destroying ourselves, we do great destruction to other people and to other things. We can't live like this. We have to have the leadership on top. We have to have from them some assurance that they have a plan for the future. There must be a plan for the future. And the plan must be something more than sterilization. We have to know that there is moral consciousness in the leadership of our country. We have to know that they are aware that our culture, as it has been deteriorating, and the life of America, as it has been deteriorating, has been offering less and less room in the future for human beings. And leaving us to hope for a future wherein we will be no more than robots or wild animals to be locked up or exterminated by birth pills and other forms of sterilization. Yes, birth control pills and other forms of sterilization. Dear beloved people, it can't come from the top. Only hope can come from the top to us.
But the work must come from the bottom. We must accept leadership for ourselves. I'm not directing your attention now to me. I'm talking about leadership on the ground level. We have to accept that we must lead ourselves. Because there is no leadership outside of ourselves. Where are you going to go outside of yourself for leadership? I don't see it. These people are guessing. They're hitting and missing. They're guessing. And those that are reaching the public through the media, they're not offering anything solid. They're not clearing up the picture for us. They sack me as a blind man feeling his way with a cane. So I feel the desperation. I feel the desperate urge to declare leadership on the ground level. Yes. I don't mean leadership on the ground level for the ground level. Leadership on the ground level for the nation. All that has the tone of revolution, insurrection. No, no, no. No, no, no. It has the tone of progress. There was a philosopher who long ago predicted that the increased growth in the population was going to diminish the food supply. His name is Thomas Malthus, I believe, and the theory is the Malthusian theory. Malthusian theory. This man made these predictions, and time passed, decades passed, decade after decade passed, and do you think the leadership in America listened to what he said? No. They didn't listen to what he said. The same principle of growth continued to be their principle. That principle is just produce goods without the man. Produce goods and create an artificial demand for the goods. Money was the sole purpose in our America. Just money, to make money, 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 money. To have more, when I say money, I'm not talking about currency. I'm talking about material comfort. The object, the sole object, was just to increase the material comfort. Not for the consumer, for the rich man. His big appetite for more and more materialism in his life and for more and more material power so he can preserve his way of life by enforcing it upon those who don't like it, made them just produce more and more good, whether there was a natural need or want for it or not. One
economists from Europe gave the answer to some other economists who had all convened there in Europe to see where they should move from that point where they were. And the admission that they made was that we have enough material things in our life in America. We have satisfied all human needs. Now, who were they talking about? You know, I'm sure it wasn't you and me. But what they meant was that we have enough in America to satisfy those who can get it, or those that are allowed to get it. You can have TVs, radios, car, automobiles, boats, yachts. You can have anything you want. Chicken, beef, hamburgers, everything. Pork chops,